जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी गोपी जन बाल गोपी जन बाल बन यशोरनन्दना ब्रज जनरन्दना ब्रज जनरन्दना ब्रजमुना तीरानन्दारे तेरा माधव कुंज बिहारी माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी Before we get started, I just wanted to personally welcome back Ranshaw and Rama Devi. Many of you may not know that they spend half their year in Guyana doing some very, very nice preaching down there, and the other half of the year up here, so they've just returned after about 3 or 4 months down there. Welcome back. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter, canto 10, chapter 4, text number 2 and 3. We'll chant the Sanskrit for both of them together in a row. Te tu, tunam, upavrajyam, Evakya, Varbya, Jamma, Tep, Akarbya, Akarya, Boja, Rajaya, Yad, Udvigna, Patikshate, Tetu Tunu Pavrajan, Tetu Tunu Pavrajan, Devatya Garbhajan Matat.
Devatya Garbhajan Matat.
Achapyor Bojarajayu. Yad Udvigna Pratikshate. Te tu tunam upavrajya. Devakya Garbhajan Matat. Aka Achapya Bojarajaya. Yad Udvigna Pratikshate. Text number 3. Satalpatunamutaya. Kaloyam iti vijvala. Suti griham hagatunam. Prakshalam mukti murvaja. Satalpatunamutaya. Kaloyam iti vijvala. Suti griham agatunam, prakshalam mukti mudajat. Good chant. Going before the king, Devakya of Devaki, Garbhajanma, the deliverance from the womb, that child, Achakyu submitted, Bojarajaya, unto the king of the Bojas, Kamsa. Udvigna, with great anxiety, Pratikshate, was waiting for the child's birth. Text 3. Sa, he, King Kamsa, talpat, from the bed, tunam, very quickly, uthaya, getting up, kala ayam, here is my death, the supreme time. Iti, in this way. Vijvala, overwhelmed. Suti griham, to the maternity home. Agat, went. Tunam, without delay. Pakshalam, scattering. Mukta, had become opened. Mudhaja, the hair on the head. translation. Thereafter, all the watchmen very quickly approached King Kamsa, the ruler of the Bhoja dynasty, and submitted the news of the birth of Devaki's child. Kamsa, who had awaited this news very anxiously, immediately took action. Kamsa immediately got up from bed thinking, "Here is Kala, the supreme time factor, who has taken birth to kill me." Thus overwhelmed, Kamsa, his hair scattered on his head, at once approached the place where the child had been born. Purport. Kamsa was very anxiously waiting because of the prophecy that the eighth child of Devaki would kill him. This time, naturally, he was awake and waiting, and when the watchman approached him, he immediately took action to kill the child. The word Kala is significant. Although the child was born to kill Kamsa, Kamsa thought that this was the proper time to kill the child so that he himself would be saved. Kala is actually another name for the Supreme Personality of Godhead when he appears only for the purpose of killing. When Arjuna inquired from Krishna in his universal form, "Who are you?" the Lord presented himself as Kala, death personified to kill. By nature's law, when there is an unwanted increase in population, Kala appears, and by some arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, people are killed wholesale in different ways, by war, pestilence, famine, and so on. At that time, even atheistic political leaders go to the church, mosque, or temple for protection by God or gods, and submissively say, "God willing." Before that, they pay no attention to God, not caring to know God or his will. But when Kala appears, they say, "God willing." Death is but another feature of the Supreme Kala, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. At the time of death, the atheist must submit to the Supreme Kala, and then the Supreme Personality of Godhead takes away all his possessions, Mityusava Harascham, and forces him to accept another body, Tatadehantara Prapti. This the atheist do not know. And if they do know, they neglect it so that they may go on with their normal life. The Krishna consciousness movement is trying to teach them that although for a few years one may act as a great protector or a great watchman, with the appearance of Kala, death, one must take another body by the laws of nature. Not knowing this, they unnecessarily waste their time in their occupation as watchdogs and do not try to get the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As it is clearly said, Aprapya mam nivartante nitya samsaravatmani. Without Krishna consciousness, one is condemned to continue wandering in birth and death, not knowing what will happen in one's next birth. Om Ajnana Tamadandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangumnam Jayati Girim Yakripa Tamaham Bande Sri Gurum Dinitharina Avancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vahevacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Sri Gadadha Shivasidi Gaur Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Gaur, would you be so kind as to open that door? Thank you.
So, first I want to thank Jugal Kishore for seeing me standing in the crowd yesterday going, "Oh, I need somebody to fill in. You're the guy." So, thank you very much. This is actually the first opportunity I've had to speak on the 10th canto since we started it. It's actually kind of nice. I can remember when in this very temple room we were speaking on the third canto. So it's nice to have lived in one temple long enough to progressively work all the way through from the third canto all the way up to the tenth. It's not a common situation for most devotees in ISKCON. It's like seven cantos of the Bhagavatam to stay in one place. So, in this particular chapter, the title is the Atrocities of King Kamsa. Mother Ruchira spoke a bit yesterday going over the summary of the verse as to what we can expect, but just by the title alone, we know what to expect. I mean, we all have been around long enough, we know that King Kamsa is a horrendous personality. We might even say in modern linguistics that he was a little bit bipolar. You know, one day he's offering his obeisances at Devaki and Vasudev, say, oh, please, oh, and the next day he's smashing their babies to the ground. One day he's going to cut off her head, and the next day, all right, I'll just put you in prison. You know, so a little unclear of his mental state of mind. But we do know that he'll do anything. And he's motivated in this way of thinking by the intense anxiety. Now, we can just imagine you could probably only imagine the level of anxiety and fear that Kamsa lived within. I mean, that may explain his so-called unsettled state of mind. We have all had the experience where if you have some very fearful or some very anxious circumstance that's long pending in your life, that it can create awkward state of mind, difficulty and unsettling circumstances and leave you feeling, you know, very just anxious, you know. And we see this here. It's described that Kamsa was anxiously awaiting, and it's not like he didn't know the details. He knew clearly. Okay, it's the eighth child. All right, so first pregnancy, okay, she carries a baby, the baby's born, okay, kill the baby, move on, second one. So all the way up like this, and the anxiety level's in building. Oh, she's had the fifth child. Oh, now it's the sixth child. Oh, it's the seventh child. The next one's the one. It's the eighth child. And so for the entire time of Devaki's pregnancy, just, you know, when's she going to be, well, the child's going to be born. This is the cause of my death, you know. And in the third verse, Prabhupada very clearly explains that he understood this is death coming to get him. So not only is he in anxiety about this whole prophecy, but he understands this is my death coming. So it's an interesting scenario. We see there he's waiting. This is the one that's going to bring about my death like that. So I thought it was interesting in the purport here, Prabhupada mentions that he was in the bed and he was naturally awake. And this is another symptom when one has a very anxiety-ridden state of mind, it's very difficult to sleep. Prabhupada said when you render devotional service, you work very hard, you hit the bed and immediately you fall right asleep. No anxiety, it's just working very hard, doing your service, very enthusiastic, very happily executing, and you can sleep very easily. But when there's just this anxiety and fear and distress and awe, you know, it's difficult to sleep. You can't even, because for the conditioned soul, their very peace of mind is by that 6 or 8 hours of ignorance each night. You know, just laying there in the mode of ignorance, just, oh, very peaceful. You know, that's the, oh, he passed away peacefully in his sleep. But many times there is no peacefully in the sleep. There's so many dreams going on in the brain. But at any rate, at least there's the appearance of that, and one can become rejuvenated. But in this state of mind, we see that he's laying in the bed, you know, I mean, we can just imagine the scenario. He's trying to get a little something, maybe toss it, you know, whatever, you know. Just he's just filled with things, his anxiety to the point to where he's not even peaceful in his sleeping. So when the guards come, Prabhupada mentions here, as they approached him, he was already awake and waiting for the news, you know. Like any day, they're going to tell me, okay. So in this way, just immediately, he jumps up out of the bed to take action. Now, in the third verse, I noticed one thing here. Let me find that just a moment here. Here we go. Suti Griham. Griha, home. Griham, that residence. So, Suti Griham. Residence of the pregnancy. So I thought it kind of gave an indication, or at least brought the question in my mind. We have this understanding of Devaki and Vasudev being in prison. There seems to be some indication by this that maybe she was, you know, in a pregnancy home. I mean, this was the tradition at that time, that the woman didn't bear the child in the residence. She went to a separate place where the child was given birth at, because of all the details and blah, blah, blah. So it seems to indicate there that there was some maternity area where she was having the child, maybe separate from the prison, maybe the prison cell next door. You know, we don't really know.
But at any rate, this indication is there that it was a separate place. So Kamsa's in this way. He decides that, you know, now is the time, and he approaches. And it mentions here in the verse that he exclaims that this is Kala who has come to kill me. Thus overwhelmed, his hair scattered on his head, he at once approached the place where the child had been born. Here again, his hair scattered on his head. This indicates that he jumped right up out of bed. No showering, no bathing, no dressing, no properly attending to himself, and immediately went to Krishna. And I think if we just take a second, we can remember some other individuals that similarly would run to Krishna in a disheveled condition. You know, maybe their top cloth on their bottom and their bottom cloth on their top, and maybe their hair tied or not tied, or half their makeup on and half of it not on. So this is, of course, the gopis. So when they would run to Krishna, they're... we have an external appearance of two entirely similar situations. Two personalities running to Krishna. Of course, in this case, it's not really Krishna there, but this is Kamsa's understanding. Two personalities running to Krishna, but the motive, which goes to speak of the heart, of the consciousness, is entirely different. Kamsa is thinking, ah, Krishna's there, I'm running, I'm going to get him, I'm going to kill him before he kills me. Because he knows it's going to happen. The gopis, oh, our dear Lord is calling us, we're running to serve him. Both are in a somewhat disheveled condition. Both are eagerly seeking the darshan of Krishna, but the consciousness, the motivation, will bring about a completely different result. And this is what's very important about how we execute our devotional service, is our consciousness. So, this is indicated here by the way it mentions, actually the Sanskrit is right there. What is the... Prakshalan Mukti Muraja, open scattered hair on the head. So this indicates that one has gone outside not in a proper condition. I mean, what's the last thing any of us do, at least some of us, before we leave the house? We look in the mirror, everything's in place? Okay, good, okay. All right, now what's the last thing we do before we open the curtains? Or in some cases, as we do here, once the curtains are open, we show Krishna in the mirror. Here's how you look, you know? Everything all right? Oh, no, wait, that's wrong. Okay, all right, there we go, okay? You know? So this indicates that someone has taken some time before presenting themselves publicly. Kamsa's not doing that. The urgency of getting to Krishna is there. So we can kind of take a little impetus from that, and we should also be urgently striving to get to Krishna, not that we come to the temple with our dhoti and our chadar and our, you know, back and forth like that, or we don't fix our hair, put on our tilaka, or whatever, but we should feel that type of urgency to get to Krishna. So that in one sense, we can draw that good example from Kamsa. You know, it's Chanakya Pandit's very fond in many places of pointing out what one can ascertain from different scenarios to one's benefit. So from Kamsa, in this sense, we can ascertain that he very quickly, enthusiastically, with no reserve, wanted to get to Krishna. But then the rest of the story steps in. So he mentions that he's ready to kill the child because he understands that this child is going to kill him. Now, Prabhupada kind of notes in the purport here the dual functions of Kala. That Kala, time, as we also know this word Kala means time, refers to time, that Krishna has come to kill Kamsa. That is Kamsa's time, that Krishna is manifested to relieve the burden of the world, and the way he's going to do that is to kill Kamsa. And at the same time, Kamsa's thinking, I've come to kill Krishna. Now this is completely the atheistic mentality, which Prabhupada refers to a little bit later here. That the atheistic mentality is that, you know, I'm going to take the place of God, that I'm going to become most prominent, that all attention should be towards me, that I'm the center of focus, like that. And in reality, we're not, because Krishna, through his agency of time, completely removes our prominence by the process of death. We think we're, you know, so important. We think we have complete control over everything. But in reality, death comes and takes everything away from us. Prabhupada, the supreme Kala, as the personality of Godhead, takes away all the possessions, mrityu sarvaharas chaham, and forces one to accept another body, tatra deham tara prapti. So, forces us. This isn't a desire. We don't have a desire that, oh, now I actually want to give up this body and go into some suffering condition and then be born again into another womb and suffer in the womb for so many months and then come out and do it all over again. But somehow or another, due to the impact of time, the illusion is created. Now, Prabhupada mentions when that illusion is shattered by difficulty, and he refers to political leaders here, but it applies to pretty much across society, that we turn to God. Classically, in one other lecture, Prabhupada refers to the Apollo, I think it was Apollo 10, when they had that difficulty and they didn't know if they were actually been a movie out of it. It's a big historical thing in American aero flight history, that when the Apollo spaceship wasn't able to return, there was some malfunction, they thought the astronauts had died. It was requested all the Americans should pray to God to save the astronauts. So Prabhupada says like that. But otherwise, they don't care for God. They're not interested. So this is the mentality. And it's symptomatic of the godlessness of the leaders. That God is more or less at their disposal. That when we need God, we'll call and pray to Him. But otherwise, it's all our doing. You know, what do we need God for? There's no need for religion like that. So Prabhupada describes this as lip service. This has nothing to do with real service to God or realization of the personality of God has influence. So this influence of time is something that's constantly present in our lives. I mean, even in our language, we say, oh, I'm just killing time. You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just killing time, waiting for, you know. But in reality, time is killing us. So it's just robbing day by day of the different activities of the form, our human life, our human form of life. So in this way, we have to kind of refocus ourselves in the process of devotional service, that we utilize our time properly. We don't have much. We don't have any great intelligence. We don't have any vast wealth. I mean, even if we do think we have vast wealth, your Bill Gates and your Malcolm Forbes, I mean, comparatively, they don't really have such great wealth. I mean, maybe in our modern times, they appear to have a lot of paper money. But real wealth, assets, cows, land, you know, things of this nature, you know, what to speak of good qualities. So even if we think we have these things, the fact of the matter is by the process of devotional service, we can appreciate what actually is available to us. So as Vaishnavas, we never want to waste that time because we realize what an important thing that time is. Prabhupada was so fond of saying, you can't buy time back for any amount of money. So we want to utilize our time in developing our Krishna consciousness, in developing our devotional service. And in this way, as Prabhupada says at the end of the purport here, we should not waste our time, but we should seek out the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this reminded me of that wonderful verse at the end of the Gita, that all activities performed, whatever we do, should be done as an offering to the Personality of Godhead. So in this way, we want to seek the Lord's mercy. This is the opposite between a devotee and a non-devotee. A devotee, we've already mentioned, is very much absorbed in their own abilities and their own accomplishments. But a devotee realizes that everything is by the mercy of the Lord. And that my ability to accomplish anything is only going to be by the mercy of the Lord, the mercy of the Vaishnavas. Therefore, a devotee is constantly in a state of mind of seeking the blessings of the Vaishnavas, seeking the blessings of Guru, seeking the blessings of the Personality of Godhead, so that their life will be beneficial, so that they will have spiritual good fortune within their life. The last sentence here Prabhupada uses a very, very strong word. Without Krishna consciousness, one is condemned to continue wandering in birth and death, not knowing what will happen in one's next birth. Condemned. If you hear that phrase, we find the defendant condemned to life in prison, condemned to death by hanging, condemned to lethal injection. It's a very heavy thing. You feel like, oh. But in this material world, we're condemned to suffer. And so Prabhupada says this is the situation of the living entity of the jiva without the influence of Krishna consciousness, that we're condemned to a very difficult lifestyle.
So this process of devotional service, this process of Krishna consciousness, is what can save the jiva, what can save us from our suffering condition. So to this end, Lord Chaitanya, he instructed these six Goswamis that they should spread Krishna consciousness through the writings of different literatures and the example in their own life. And one of the greatest of these personalities, of course, is Jiva Goswami. And today is the disappearance day of Jiva Goswami. So this verse deals with the subject of death. It's a disappearance day. But the death, as it pertains to the atheist, to the mundane personality, and the disappearance of a great saintly personality are two completely vast different worlds. For the conditioned living entity, death comes, as we see and comes in here, very fearful, very anxiety-ridden, overwhelmed with distress. And then they're forced, as Prabhupada says, tattu deham tara prapti, forced to take another body. For the greatly advanced acharya, for the pure devotee of the Lord, death comes by their own sweet will, and they simply move on to another lila of the Lord's pastimes. So this is the difference between that death that is forced on the living entity by their karma and that death which is a part of the eternal pastimes. For the acharya, as Srila Prabhupada pointed out, the appearance and the disappearance are non-different. We celebrate them both, very much attentive to the actual life of them. So in Jiva Goswami's life, we see that he came from a very exalted lineage. His father and his uncles were Sanatan and Rupa were the uncles, and Balaba Anupam was his father. And the three of them were all employed in Ramkeli in the service of the Shah, and they were engaged in different ministerial roles. We know the history of Rupa and Sanatan like this. And of the three, there was only one descendant, and that was Jiva Goswami. So you can imagine he was the darling of the family. You know, he was the only child and very attended to. Plus, they lived a life of great opulence. They were very well rewarded for their service. We've read in the stories of Rupa and Sanatan how comfortable their lifestyle was in that service to the Hussein Shah. And so, very the lap of luxury, as they say. This house was always filled with great opulence, but it mentions that by the appearance of Jiva Goswami, the effulgence of opulence in the house increased greatly. He was considered, just by the physical display of his body, to be a Mahapurush, to be a great personality. Lotus-like eyes, a high nose, broad forehead, broad chest, long arms, golden effulgent body. So when Lord Chaitanya came to Ramkeli, Jiva Goswami, of course, was just a little boy, a very young child, a baby actually at the time. But he was able to have the darshan of Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya actually placed the dust from his feet on the head of Jiva Goswami. And he indicated that in the future, this personality will be the greatest preceptor of the Gaudiya line. So Jiva Goswami, although he was just a little child at the time, mere baby, he kept this form fixed in his mind of Lord Chaitanya. And as he grew up, whether he would be eating or lying down or playing, or at all times he would meditate on this golden form he had seen of Lord Chaitanya. So in due course of time, he acquired the age for schooling, and he studied under the local pundits. He was extremely proficient in grammar and poetry and rhetoric and logic, all of the different teachings. Actually, the appreciation of his high level of intelligence was expressed by all of his teachers. And they predicted he would become a great saintly person of vast knowledge and learning. So one of his teachers actually commented, "Such brilliance is not often found in a child this young. No doubt he is a very elevated personality and will bring great fortune to the world at large." So Srimad Bhagavatam became Jiva's life and soul. Even as a young child, he just relished the hearing of Krishna Katha. And no one dared come before him and speak any type of nonsense or mundane topics. He just wouldn't hear it. Now, as a child, he had his deities, and his deities were Krishna and Balaram. Brass deities. Now, of course, you know, I mean, we think brass deities, though they're smaller, but, you know, still for a child, they're quite heavy. But he would take them with him everywhere. He would grasp them in both arms, and he would carry them out to the play field with him and set them on a tree stump or on a short wall or whatever. And all the kids would play different activities and the pastimes of Krishna and Balaram. And then Jiva would offer some prasadam to them and then distribute it to all the playmates and tell different stories of Krishna and Balaram. And so these deities, they became his entire life and soul as a child. Even to the point when he would go to sleep at night, not that our children should try this, but he would take his deities and he would lay down and he'd clutch his brass deities to his chest. They're very heavy. So when he would fall asleep, mother would try to take them from his hand and put them on the shelf. Couldn't get them. They would grasp very tightly there. So this was his way. And the parents, this brought them great joy, and the villagers all very much appreciated seeing him like this, you know. So one time, there was a dream that Jiva had. And in this dream, he saw that his worshipable forms of Krishna and Balaram had manifested themselves as Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda. And they were dancing very ecstatically. And when they were dancing, they reached down, took the dust from their feet, and put it on Jiva Goswami's head. So this was in his dream. And then in the dream, they disappeared. So this was a great consolation to Jiva Goswami. You know, he just felt so blessed, and this really was a wonderful thing to him, because as he was maturing into his teens, he was very anxious to get out of his family life. He had a great interest to just engage in the service of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda in the Sankirtan mission. It mentions that his thought process was this: when will I be able to crawl out of this well of family life and devote my full time and my full energy, my very self, to serving these two most magnanimous lords? So, you know, he was the only son, and the father and the uncles had already gone away. Anupam had departed, Balaba, his father, and Rupa and Sanatan had left the service there and had gone to Vrindavan. And so it mentions that once he learned that his father had departed, his whole life just became completely difficult, and just the separation of his uncles and his father, and they'd all gone, and he was just constantly in a state of crying, and just constantly in a distressed condition due to the separation of these great devotees, who happened to be his senior family members. So the local devotees, Bhakti Ratnakar mentions that the local devotees suggested, you should go to Navadvip. You should go to Navadvip, and Lord Nityananda is there. And you can associate with him, and maybe that will relieve the anxiety. Bathe in the ocean of the Nityananda's association, and maybe that will relieve the anxiety that you're feeling. So in this way, he continued on. And when he went to Navadvip, actually Nityananda arranged that he traveled also. And Nityananda is the all-pervading super soul in the heart of all living entities. And he understood Jiva's going to Navadvip, so he traveled to Navadvip as well. And there's an entire chapter in Bhakti Ratnakar that goes into great detail, which we'll pass over for this particular class, since it's not exclusively about Jiva Goswami. And describes very great detail the different personalities that they met, and the mercy and the blessings Jiva Goswami got, and how he spent some time there traveling and all like this. So from there, he was sent to Varanasi to study under Madhusudana and Vaschapati. And he studied the Vedas, because you remember Varanasi at that time was a great seat of Vedic study, and so he studied all the Vedas and became extremely well versed in all the different fields of Vedic knowledge. And after residing there for some time, then he went to Vrindavan. He had a great desire within his heart to get the association of and take shelter at the lotus feet of his two uncles, Rupa and Sanatan. So he traveled to Vrindavan, and when he arrived there, they were so pleased to see him, because, you know, the news of Jiva's advancement Just as within ISKCON, a particular devotee advances very nicely and becomes very well known and makes a good name for themselves spiritually, and devotees know about that far and wide and they speak about such a personality. So Rupa and Sanatan were aware of the wonderful level of devotional service of Jiva Goswami. So when he came to Vrindavan, they were so happy to receive him, aside from the fact he was their dear nephew. So in this way, they were very happy to have him, and they listened to him all the news of what was going on in Navadvip and who had departed and who was renewing what service and how his mother was doing and all the different things like this. And so after getting him settled and all, then Rupa and Sanatan, they began to teach the Srimad Bhagavatam to Jiva Goswami. Actually, it was mostly Rupa instructing him in Srimad Bhagavatam. And seeing that Jiva very quickly mastered the understanding of Srimad Bhagavatam, he engaged him in proofreading and editing his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So very quickly, Jiva came to the point to where his uncle Rupa had him editing his books. So we can just understand, I mean, we all know the caliber and quality of the writings of Rupa Goswami, and so this boy Jiva, okay, you take care of editing and proofreading my books for me. Amazing task. So during this time, Sanatana Goswami was writing his Vaishnava Toshani, which was a commentary on Bhagavatam, and so he also had Jiva Goswami proofread that. And so then under Sanatana Goswami's instruction, Jiva wrote some books of his own in this way. And so, you know, he was associating with all these six Goswamis. He was the junior of the six of them, and associating with them and serving them like this. This time period is considered to be the golden age of Braj. This is Lord Chaitanya has just been there, and the Goswamis are there, and they're churning out the nectar. All the different books and literatures are coming out, and Krishnadas Kaviraj is producing the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and all of these great activities are going on. All the deities are being found. The temples are all being established at this time. It's just an amazing time in the history of Vrindavan. So at this time, Jiva Goswami took his initiation from Rupa Goswami. He received the divine mantra from him, and Rupa Goswami engaged him in the worship of Radha and Damodar. And so, of course, we know that Radha Damodar were fashioned by Rupa Goswami himself, and so he engaged his disciple, Jiva, in this service. Now, during this time, Balabhacharya, who's a very aged scholar at that time, he came to Vrindavan, and, you know, for some reason, he had some disagreement with something Rupa had written. So anyway, he pointed out some fault in the writing to Rupa Goswami, who very politely took that instruction. But when Jiva heard about this, he thought, how is it he dares to instruct Rupa Goswami like that? So he went to Balabha and he corrected him. He actually chastised him a bit. And it mentions here that he actually, you know, Balabha was elder than him, but he felt that Balabha had offended Rupa Goswami in this way. So he gave him some strong correction in this way. You know, polite, but, you know, by the way, you know, Rupa Goswami, so. At any rate, Rupa Goswami came to hear about this. And so he called Jiva, and he said, you are a young boy. He said, you are not yet in control of your passions, and you do not know how to behave amongst sadhus. Therefore, leave Vrindavan. Don't live here any longer. Go. So he banished him from Vrindavan. So Jiva Goswami was devastated by this. He realized he had committed some great offense, and so he went to reside in one place about 45 minutes from where Rupa Goswami was living, and it was a crocodile hole. It was actually some kind of a small cave where a crocodile had previously lived. And so he lived in this place, and he fasted. Actually, he didn't fast entirely, but it might as well have been fasting. He would take wheat flour that he would bake from the villagers and mix it with a little Jamuna water, and once a day, that's all he would eat. So in this way, he was becoming very emaciated and, you know, such severe austerity, and the local residents saw this. This young sadhu was making so many serious austerities, and he's just
you know, disappearing before our eyes. So they went to Sanatan. Sanatan Goswami was very commonly engaged by the residents of Braja in resolving disputes and things. He was a very approachable individual, and he would, husband and wife would come to him with some problem, and he would solve it out for them, or, you know, a young child had not properly acted in their school, and so all the village things, somehow or another, were brought to Sanatan, and he very happily sorted these things out. So the villagers, who were going to go to? So they went to Sanatan Goswami. Goswami, this is boy here, you know. So Sanatan went to Rupa one day, in a very clever way. He said to him, he said, you know, Rupa, he said, I'm very distressed by your, something you're doing. No, what am I doing? You're rejecting one of the most important instructions of our Prabhu, indicating what you're telling me. I've not followed? Well, please, what have I not followed? Mahaprabhu said that we should have mercy on all jivas. And you are neglecting your jiva. So Rupa could understand the play in words there that Sanatan was giving him. So he said, all right. So he brought Jiva Goswami back and properly engaged him again in service and all like that. So after the disappearance of Sanatan and Rupa Goswami's, Jiva Goswami continued in all of the traditions that they had established in the worshipping of the deities and in the writing of books and in the vast preaching and, very importantly, in the training of disciples. He was actually the Sampradaya Acharya at the time for you know, all of the Vaishnavas, Navadvipa, Vrindavan, Jagannath Puri. He was accepted in that role by all of them, all the followers of Mahaprabhu. And, of course, we know at that time, he began to train three young boys, Shyamananda, Srinivas, and Narottam. And anyway, at this time, there was different activities going on in Vrindavan and in the nearby area of Agra. And there was one big Rajput that had some debate going on concerning the glories of the Jamuna. There is a similar debate going on nowadays concerning the glories of the Jamuna, but a little different focus. But at any rate, there was a debate amongst pundits hosted by this Rajput in Agra as to which was more glorious, the Ganga or the Jamuna. So Jiva Goswami came and was invited to this, and he came and he spoke, and he explained in great detail how the Ganga really emanates from the lotus feet of the Lord, whereas the Jamuna is the personal consort of the Lord in all of his playful activities and all of his divine leela in Vrindavan. Therefore, the Jamuna is considered more beneficial, is the higher. So in this way, his conclusion was accepted. The king was very, very happy, and the king offered him, please, let me give you a present. You take anything, I will give it to you. So Jiva Goswami said, oh, no, I don't need it. No, please, you must take something from me. All right, give me some blank paper. Now, we might think, some blank paper? You mean like some typing paper? Some blank typing paper? But at that time, paper was a great commodity. A very rare thing. And the Rajput had stacks of this very, very nicely, described, very nicely stained paper. Not stained like somebody put a tea mug on it, but stained different types of, you know, designs and all. So he gave this big stack of this to Jiva Goswami, which Jiva used for writing on. This became some of the manuscripts like that. Then there was one other time that the mogul, this same mogul, wanted to give one benediction to Jiva. And Jiva said, all right, I'll ask one, and there's a word for it, a farman. It's an emperor's order. I'll ask one request from you. That is that no longer do the Rajputs come to the Vrindavan forest for the purpose of hunting animals. That no animals in Vrindavan will be killed. So this became a ruling. And they say to this day that's followed, well, to some degree. You know, there's some kinds of animal slaughter in Braj Mandala. But at any rate, this was the king's thing. Now, recently, those of you that may be associated with Indraduna Maharaj on his Facebook page, he and Giriraj Goswami and Govinda Swami, they went to one wildlife reserve in Braj Mandala. It's about 45 minutes from Vrindavan, where all kinds of wild animals are. It's like Vrindavan in its old days. There's herds of blue deer and herds of antelope and pythons and jackals and all kinds and variety of colorful birds. It's a very beautiful place. And the game warden there took them around and showed them all this fabulous pictures of all these things. So there are some places like that still left in Vrindavan, just a little side note there. So Jiva Goswami was considered, of course, to be the most prolific of all the Goswamis. It's stated that he wrote 500,000 Sanskrit verses, 500,000 verses, about 25 books or so like that. And there are three, this is always mentioned, there are three particular mistruths, three particular arguments, bogus statements that the Avaishnava personalities make about Jiva Goswami. One is the story of Balaba, and in that story they say this is simply a symptom of the excessive pride of Jiva Goswami, that he would chastise Balaba. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and Srila Prabhupada all greatly denounce this and explain that this is the essence of the disciple and guru relationship that was manifested in this pastime between Rupa and Jiva Goswami. How the guru came, the disciple came to the guru's aid when he felt he was offended, and how when the guru felt that the disciple had misbehaved, that he chastised him, and how the disciple took that chastisement on his head and embraced it as life as soul, and then how by that the guru brought the disciple back. So they explain like that. So the second one is there's this story that when Krishnadas Kaviraj, and these are stories that are actually told by people of dubious character at best, that when Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami finished his Chaitanya Charitamrita, everyone was bringing their books to Jiva Goswami for proofreading, and so he brought it to Jiva Goswami to proofread. And Jiva Goswami read it and said, oh, this is so good, this will overshadow any of my own work, and he threw it in a well. So they actually tell this story, like anybody could believe it. But anyway, and then by result of that, Krishnadas Kaviraj died of shock. So how they proposed this story, I can't even imagine. But anyway, this is another one of the bogus stories that is indicated. And the third one is that the story is that Jiva Goswami did not believe in Parkiya Ras, but only supported Svakiya Ras, that he didn't support the Parkiya Ras. So the explanation given by the Acharyas is that this was his ability to present both points of view as they're both present in the Leelas of the divine couple. And so these are three arguments that if you should ever be speaking about Jiva Goswami and anybody brings them up, you can soundly defeat those. So a little bit of the life of Jiva Goswami, and just in the little bit of time that I've already run over, we'll take a couple of minutes and speak about Jagdish Pandit. Jagdish Pandit was one of the, during Krishna Lila, he was one of the two, one of two of the Yajnik Brahmana wives who had given their prasad, the feast and all, to Krishna Balaram when they were traveling. It's interesting because Jagdish Pandit was one of those personalities in Gaura Lila that was considered to be both Nityananda Shaka and Chaitanya Shaka. That he was a branch of both trees. If you read in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he's described on both branches. He was born in the town of Guwahati, which is in what we now call modern-day Assam, and his father's name was Kamalaksha. His parents were both great devotees of the Lord, and when they died, he and his wife, Dukini, and he had two brothers. There were the three brothers, Jagadish, Mahesh, and Hiranya. And so the three of them, they moved to Mayapur, just on the shores of the Ganges there, and they built a home right next door to Jagannath Mishra, just very, very close. And, next door is a relative point. If you live in Alachua, next door is like right there. If you live out here, next door is the next 5-acre plot. So at any rate, right near Jagannath Mishra, they built a home. And Jagadish Pandit and Dukini became the best and closest of friends with Jagannath Mishra and Sachimata. So in this way, actually, to the point that sometimes mothers will know this, that there was a need for feeding the baby, but the mother wasn't there, so they engaged another lady, we'd be called a wet nurse. And so Dukini would sometimes be Nimai Pandit's wet nurse. So very, very close relationship. You don't just have anybody, oh, could you feed my kid, please? There's got to be some tight friendship there. So in this way, the four were very closely associated in this way. And then Jagadish Pandit and Dukini, they had a nice son. His name was Ramabhadra. So Mahaprabhu was very, very fond of Jagadish, of course, in a very uncle-type way. And, you know, he would always trick them into chanting the holy name, just when he would cry and all like this, just to get Jagadish and Dukini, when they would come over, to try and console him just by chanting. You know, we all know that story. There was a very interesting story related to them. And one time in the home of Jagannath Mishra and Sachimata, Nimai Pandit was crying just incessantly. Crying. They couldn't restrain him. They just, nothing would stop him. So, what do you want? What's wrong, my child? He said, we'll give you anything. Just stop your crying. He said, okay. He said, today, in the home of Jagadish Pandit, he's made a very elaborate offering of grains to Lord Vishnu. Even though it's a codicil, I want some of those grains. You get me those grains, I'll stop crying. That's kind of interesting. He's child enough to whine, and grown up enough to clearly say, okay, you want me to stop whining, here's what you got to do. So, this is the pastime of Mahaprabhu. So, Jagannath Mishra was amazed. How is Nimai saying these things? And even more so, how does he know what's going on at Jagadish Pandit's house? It's not like they had the internet, he was on Facebook. Oh, I just made a big offering to Vishnu. So, at any rate, Jagannath Mishra went to his neighbor's home, and sure enough, he was surprised. There was this huge offering of different types of palatable grains to Lord Vishnu. And so, Jagannath Mishra told him, he said, you know, Nimai is, you know, I mean, it's a codicil, but, you know, this, he's asked to eat it. So, when he's a child, you know, what was it Prabhupada said? 9 to 90, before 9 and after 90. You know, before 8 and after 80, you don't have to follow a codicil. And maybe before 70 and after 70 anyway. Before 6 and after 60. So they took the entire offering over to Nimai Pandit. Then little Nimai, he sat down and ate it all in great, great happiness. And all his friends, he gathered around and passed it out to all of them. And said, oh, this big feast on the codicil. So in this way, they were all very charmed by just this amazing pastime of Nimai Pandit with Jagadish Pandit, you know. So before Mahaprabhu took sannyas, he ordered that Jagadish should move to Puri and take care of the Lord, the service in Puri and preach there. And so he went and he joined the Harinam movement there. And when he arrived, he became completely infatuated and just in love with Lord Jagannath. And he would daily go for the darshan of Lord Jagannath. And anyway, in some period of time later, it was arranged for him to return back to Bengal. But upon the idea of having to leave and return to Bengal without his Lord Jagannath, it was just, oh, he was just crying, the idea of separating, and he just couldn't bear it. So Lord Jagannath came to know about this. Lord Jagannath is after all the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the heart of all living entities. So he came to know this. So he appeared before the Raja of Puri in a dream. Now, at that time, Navakalevara. Navakalevara is the time when they changed the body of Lord Jagannath. So it happened to be that Navakalevara was taking place at that time. So Lord Jagannath appeared in a dream to the king of Puri and said the old form, because traditionally what they do with the old form is they have a huge lake there in the Puri temple filled with water. It's a kund, really, not a big lake. And they put the deity in there and let it just dissolve, the wood and the water, and over the course of time it dissolves. So the Lord Jagannath appeared to the king Puri and said, you give me to Jagadish and let him take me back to Bengal. Now, I just began to think, now, the big Jagannath, or is it like Utsava deities? Or? So the answer to that is that when the king came to Jagadish Pandit and told him this, Jagadish Pandit said, how am I going to carry this deity? He's big, he's heavy, how am I going to transport him? So that night, Lord Jagannath came to him in a dream, said, not to worry. I will be as light as a feather. So sure enough, the next morning when Jagadish Pandit went, he just lifted right up. So he had kind of it's described as a stick litter, which he tied the deity to and drug it, you know, kind of carried it from Puri to Bengal. Now, I've taken a train from Mayapur to the border of Puri, and that was a 10-hour train ride overnight. So it was a little bit of a journey. At any rate, when they got to the town, when they got into Bengal on the Ganges to the town of Chukdaha, it's now called Chukdaha, it used to be called Chukradaha, because this is the place where when Bhagirathi was bringing the Ganges down, he buried his wheel from his chariot there, and it became known as Chukradaha. But then over the course of time, it shortened Chukdaha. So at any rate, when they got to this place, Lord Jagannath, you know, just they stopped there, you know. And so, Jagadish left Lord Jagannath with one of the local Brahmins and went to the river to take bath. And when he returned and went to, Jagannath wasn't going anywhere. He was heavy again. Of course, Jagannath's always very heavy. He's the personality of God, the master of the universe. But his form became very heavy again. And Jagadish Pandit could understand, oh, this is where he wants to stay. So to this day, that temple there, they have the worship of Lord Jagannath, and they have the original stick litter in that temple. They say this is the stick litter that was used to drag him from there to there. So just a little bit about Jagadish Pandit, and we'll finish there. Otherwise, I can ramble on for hours about the Vaishnava Charya. So, at any rate, in conclusion, this Kala, this death that we're talking about in this section of the 10th canto, this takes away the life and takes away the possessions of the non-devotee, but for the devotee, it gives us an opportunity to simply continue on in our service of the personality of Godhead. If we fix ourselves very nicely, we can just continue on like that in our next birth, hopefully with Krishna and all of his devotees. So we'll finish there. Unless there's some really important questions, we'll stop because I've run about overtime. Pushkarji.
Nimai demanded that they do that they follow a codicil. That was one of the things. Like even though he broke it himself,
right?
I thought that the final thing was just, but Sachimata has to always follow a codicil. Don't eat grain. Everybody shouldn't eat grain. So he started calling attention to that rule. I thought, right? Wasn't it?
I don't think those two pastimes are related. I think they're two separate pastimes.
Oh, it's the same.
Reread it.
All right. All glories to Jiva Goswami.